Welcome to episode 209 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and today I'm joined on the podcast by Cecilia Ekback, whose The Historians was recently published. Welcome to Speaking of Mysteries, Cecilia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get going, I've been asking this of all the writers I've spoken to in the past few months. This is, to put it mildly, a very unusual time to be launching a book. So this is, I believe, your third novel. So how is this different than previous launches?
Well, I really miss people. I think we all do. It's interesting to live this. I mean, it's terrible and it's frightening, but it's also interesting to sort of see what pieces we miss the most. And I think when you write, you are so much in isolation already. You know, it's you, your head, and the page basically for a number of years before your book comes out. And then you have this little flurry of activity when the book comes out, when you actually meet people and get to discuss it with people and see people. And now that is not quite happening. But we're doing a lot on Zoom, which is interesting. And part of me thinks that maybe this is how it will continue in some ways. Because, of course, for someone to travel from bookstore to bookstore, you know, may not be viable whilst you can actually sit at home and reach the same amount of people. It's not the same thing, but you can reach people and you can have a conversation sort of from your home. So, yeah, different times indeed. Yeah.
I sort of think that it might be a hybrid. You know, I've had a great deal of fun. Yeah. I was able to attend Bloody Scotland, even though I was here in Los Angeles. I've been able to go to Noir at the Bars all over the country and be in my pajamas.
Yeah, and, exactly.
So I'm hoping that this will be a hybrid and that many, many more people will get to enjoy panels and enjoy meeting writers they might not otherwise have met. So, you know, that, but it's just an odd time. And I feel particularly bad for debut writers who might not.
Yes, that's true. Yes, yes.
So I'm a sucker for historical mysteries, and specifically those set before, during, and just after World War II. I'm in no way alone. This is not your first historical mystery, but I'm curious what drew you to 1943 Sweden as a time and a place to set your story.
Yeah, well, I started this endeavor in my first book. So my three books have all been set on the same fictitious mountain, or had that mountain as one of the settings, Blackåsen Mountain. And what I wanted to do was to see how place changes over time. I've sort of been toying with this idea that if place got to be a character, you know, what would it be like and what would it come to bear on the people that sort of came in its path? So the first book was set in the 1700s, the second book was set in the 1800s, and I knew I wanted the third book to be set in the early 1900s to capture the sort of development of the iron industry. And then, you know, I didn't really want to write a World War II book because there are already so many fantastic, amazing novels out there. And I also felt that research, I was a bit worried about the research because it is, of course, tons of things to read and so on. But I changed my mind as I was sort of going and as I was reading about the period, I thought, but actually not that much have been done from the Scandinavian perspective. And yet, you know, Scandinavia or the Nordic countries had a big role, I feel, in the war. So we know Denmark and Norway were occupied by the Germans. Sweden was neutral within quotation marks because we let Germany pass through Sweden to occupy Norway with their soldiers. And we were also incredibly worried about about what Germany could do to us. And 80% of Germany's iron came in periods from Sweden. So we had a huge role there that we played. And then Finland ended up fighting with Germany, fighting the USSR, which was their big sort of enemy. So I thought, you know, so not much has been written about this. They had, these countries had a role to play. And I thought it is interesting to sort of set a novel there. And so that's what I did. And something that I sort of kept thinking about was these Nordic countries that had used to be in union with each other for much of the past, and that considered each other as brothers to some extent. And then they ended up having this very different experience of the war. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if you put that in a book? So you let a few people represent these countries, and they're the best of friends, the closest of friends. The war breaks out and they end up on different sides, or at least with very different experiences. And then you pull them back together again to solve a crime. But now they have this war in their very recent past, and their loyalties are not the same as they were before the war. So that's how the historians sort of came to be.
Well, I have to say, I was blown away by the idea of the three Scandinavian kings of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden meeting twice before each of the world wars, and the implications, both sinister and otherwise, that they had. And if it hadn't actually happened, you might have had to make it up. Now, I realize, without introducing spoilers, it didn't really... it was not nefarious necessarily, the real event, but it's an interesting thing to think about, isn't it?
It is an interesting twist that they did meet. And yes, The Historian is a big sort of what if book. So what if, you know, a country would have acted on things that they felt to be true, or on sort of admirations that they had, you know, where do you draw that line in the sand? So it is a big what if book. But the kings did meet. And I thought, when I read it, I thought, what a brilliant sort of thing, you know, what could you use that for as an author, if you like? Now, the second meeting was quite sad, because the kings met, but somebody else was also there, and that was the Finnish leader. And he pleaded with the others to help him because he knew that they would very soon be attacked by the USSR. And they all declined and said that they were going to stay neutral. So it had that very sad sort of little event going on the side, if you like.
Well, it's, and this is a little bit of a sidebar, but so much of what's going on today, at least in the political realm, had its origins during World War II. For example, Finland is not part of NATO this day, because they don't want to offend no longer the USSR, but they don't want to offend Russia. It's still it's a tense kind of relationship.
It is. And I mean, that is also what Sweden lived during World War II. The enemy, the big enemy, was USSR. And that was the one, you know, if there came to be a choice between Germany and the USSR, it was clear what Sweden would prefer. And that sort of, you know, based on our history and with the USSR. And of course, for the Finland and the Baltic countries, it's very much the same. The World War II, of course, left huge marks on sort of history and on how we do things today. And I think Swedish immigration policy today is very much based on sort of, you know, our experiences during the war. And it left marks.
And I think it left marks more so in Europe than, for instance, the United States or even the Far East, because it happened there. And
I think once you live war, it is different. You know, if you live it, and but it's not happening on your grounds, I think it's different. Yes.
Okay, enough of that diversion. At the heart of the historians is a document we never actually get to see, Nordic relations through the ages, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden on a new path, which is the thesis of Britta Hallberg, who we also never really get to meet because she's murdered in the first few pages of the book. But it's her death that triggers a cascading series of events.
It is, yeah. She's got a very good friend, Laura, who can't let be. And Laura is someone who has always had everything given to her. She's got a wealthy father and a wealthy grandfather, and it's been always been the three of them, and things have sort of been put in place for her. But Britta is her best friend and the person she loves the most. And when she dies, she can't let it go. She can't stop asking questions.
Well, and she discovers the body, which
she does. Yeah,
which is jarring. And I found your description of Laura almost like a representation, maybe of Sweden. You know, she's a little bit aloof about what's going on. As you said, she's a wealthy, well-connected Swedish girl. Everything is lined up for her. She works hard and she's a hard worker, but she doesn't have that many challenges. And I sort of equated that to at least the southern part of Sweden. And we'll talk about the Sami population in the north in a second, but you know, it's livable. It's not great, but she doesn't have the experience as you described that her friends from university had, her Finnish friend, her Danish friend, and her Norwegian friend. These people all had a different war experience than she was having.
And I think that is true. I think that if you look on sort of the Swedish, so Sweden was walking a tightrope between, you know, wanting to remain neutral, not wanting to become occupied, and being very threatened by Germany, you know, to the extent that the Germans would read the Swedish newspapers and then call the foreign minister and say, Hitler hated that article, you know, watch out. So Sweden was sort of... in this sort of in between place. And I think you are right. It's not until sort of towards the end of the war that it sort of really hits home. And it hits home in Sweden when the Norwegian Jews are taken. That's when it really sort of hits home what is going on, and that Sweden has to play a different role than what it's done so far.
And of course, 1943 was the nadir of the war.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. I think the United States was really just getting going with its involvement. It didn't really start landing in Europe until the middle of 1942. Things were grim. It was, I think it's safe to say, not a good time.
No, exactly. And it still wasn't clear what was going to, the outcome of the war was by no means clear. I mean, people started to think that maybe Hitler would lose. But in Sweden, there were still a lot of people, including big parts of the military, who didn't know, who weren't certain.
And of course, Germany was taking advantage of, I believe, the Swedish scientific and industrial communities.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Anyway, once again, I could talk about this
and Me too.
For a long time. I found one of the chilling aspects of your story, and I won't get too specific because of the spoilers, is the role of myth and or religion in Swedish culture specifically. I mean, obviously myth and religion have a role in every culture, but in your book, the Swedish culture. And by 1943, Christianity was the default religion and had been for, I don't know, 1500 years. But the Samis in the north, which was the native population, another native population in the northern part of the country, had their own creation story and set of beliefs. And in the pre-Christian era, Scandinavians and Sweden worshipped the Norse gods. So is there still an, which made me start to think, was there still an undercurrent of the old beliefs in Swedish society?
Well, so it's two different sets of beliefs, if you like. The Sami people had theirs, and then there was the old sort of foreign historic Swedish beliefs. If we start with the Sami, so the Sami, like so many other indigenous people, were prosecuted for their faith, and the church was adamant that they changed their faith, and all their sort of old traditional, the drums were they had to destroy them, and they had to become Swedish, if you like, and sort of partake in church. Now, when the World War II started, Sweden had changed its philosophy with regards to the Sami, and they had gone from, you know, trying to make them Swedes to saying they will never be Swedish. A Lapp has to stay a Lapp. So Lapp is the derogatory name that we used back in the time. And that meant that they couldn't go to the Swedish schools. There should be special schools for the Sami people. They should stay reindeer herding. If you weren't reindeer herding, you couldn't even be considered a Sami, and so on. So it's still very hands-on sort of policy. And I think it's been really hard for the Sami people, because their tradition was all oral and nothing was written down. And they were forced for so long to speak the Swedish language, to use the Swedish tradition, that so much was lost, which is, of course, incredibly sad. And even though there is sort of a revival, I feel that a lot has been lost. And then Sweden and the Old Norse faith. One of my best moments writing this book was to speak to a priest in Asatru, someone who's a priest in it today. And so it does also have a following in Sweden today, the old sort of the Old Norse faith, and sort of a very active following. It's still small, though, compared to sort of Christianity and the bigger religions. But it was fascinating to hear. I hadn't quite gone, to be honest. So it was a fascinating conversation.
I bet. The other thing that struck me as interesting was the Sami, like the Navajo here in the United States, were both used as code talkers during the war because their languages had very little relationship and were complicated enough that they couldn't be understood. I loved that. It's interesting to see some parallels between and among what are considered indigenous people. But it's I think Americans especially think of Sweden as a pretty homogeneous country. And actually it's not, because there are different cultures.
No, it's not, yeah.
And so when you were constructing this book, you're telling it from numerous points of view. And as you explained, one of them is from the point of view of the mountain. So you have a location as a character. And then you have Laura, and then you have, is it Jens?
Jens, yes. Jens.
And I the way you layered that, I thought was very interesting, you know, Stockholm being a fairly small town in that socioeconomic bracket. Jens works for one of the ministers, so he's in the government, he's pretty high up, he's well connected, maybe not as well connected as Laura. But the way you interweave the stories and then have them connect, was that a, you're sort of telling the same story from these different perspectives. Was that hard to do? Is that sort of 360 degree story building, is that different than a, let's say, a straight narrative?
Well, it is different, and it's interesting this, because every book I've written, I set out to write a straight narrative, and every book I end up with, you know, a number of voices, and which really bugs me, to be honest, because it's not what I set out to do. But I think I have this. I just find it so fascinating that depending on where you look, how you look at something, from which point of view, it is different. It appears different to you. And I find that when I don't use several voices, you know, you lose out on this. You lose out on sort of seeing it from, well, it is this. Oh, no, you know, it could also be this. And so I end up with several voices to sort of get this rounded picture. And for me, it's harder in the sense that you have to get to know more people. You have to be in the heads of more people. But it's easier in the other way because you can see different things, you know, just not what one person sees, but what several people sees. And something that I found when I was doing the research for this book, what I found really interesting also was this, how history changes. You know, we say history is written by the victors. And which I think is true. And depending on which country's history you read, it is different. And I found this gem of a book, which was about the Nordic countries' narrative about the World War through the times. And, you know, depending on when you look at it, just after the war, the Nordic countries would say the war was about something. If you read 20 years later, that has shifted somewhat and the war was about something else. So in some ways, history becomes then the ultimate unreliable narrator is sort of where I ended up feeling. And I thought this was so fascinating. And but yeah, so going back to that, I end up with a number of voices and part of it is harder and part of it is easier.
I also was interested in the role of women in this book. And we should say, it's always difficult to talk about mysteries without introducing spoilers, but there is a conspiracy in this book and a pretty reasonable one that is not outlandish. It might not have happened, but it would not have been terribly unlikely for it to have happened. So Laura Britta discovers it. She writes her thesis and sends it off to Jens, who tosses it because it's an unsolicited document that shows up. But Laura sees it. Laura's a very bright woman, young woman, and she sees this for what it is. And as it's unfolding, she realizes that this is very sinister and something that must be stopped. Meanwhile, people are trying to stop her. But interestingly, she's told over and over again, oh, you're just a girl. You have no idea what's going on. Go home and, you know, behave yourself and let your father take care of you. And I think that is, it's something I'm noticing in a lot of fiction, which I think is very healthy, is especially in terms of historical fiction, especially in terms of World War II, because women played a huge role in everything from code breaking at Bletchley Park to even being honeypot spies. They were important.
They were. And I think, and we're seeing this more and more, but I think we generally have to write women back into history. and I sort of feel, you know, we're seeing those kinds of book more and more, which rejoices me because we did have a big part to play. And I think when you look at women in Sweden, so we got our rights quite late, 1919, rights to vote, but first woman in Swedish politics, not until 1940. With World War II, there was a change to this. So women were needed in the workforce and they worked hard on sort of breaking up the labor market where jobs were deemed either male or female. But they didn't really manage. So they managed during sort of the period of the war. But then after the war, things went back to pretty much what they sort of had been before. In the book, I've sort of let Laura take on this a questioning role to become sort of a thorn in the side, if you like, of the men that sort of decide. But in sort of actual fact, this role, this questioning of the government policies and questioning of our relationships with Germany were taken on by both women and men. I think if when you sort of read books about the war, I feel that the way women's perspective were different from men during that time is that not only did they now have a professional role, but they also had the looking after the home. They still had that part. So they also lived, you know, the lack of goods, how the children were scared and so on. So they were still the main homemakers. And there's a wonderful book written by, it's actually Astrid Lindgren's diary. She became famous later for Pippi Longstocking and, you know, all these sort of children's stories. But she wrote a diary during the war, which is amazing. So it has all the sort of things that are happening on a macro level in the world, in Sweden. And then she has also the micro level, you know, what's happening at home. A beautiful book. Yeah.
Well, I realize that you have this Blåkåsen, is that how it's pronounced?
Blåkåsen, yes.
Blåkåsen Mountain as a character in all your stories, but I can see two characters in this story, Laura and Jens, sort of continuing because they do make a pretty good partnership. And so this is like my typical last question. It's a roundabout way of me asking what you're working on now. Are you planning to have a story with them in it?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. You know, who knows? Things might change. But at the moment, I've actually just written the end on my next story. And it's a very different story. It's set between the wars in France. And it's more of a, it's been really hard for me because it's the first time I don't kill anyone. It's the first time I don't have a murder to get things going. And I kept saying to myself, well, if you don't kill anyone, is it even a book? I don't know.
That's the mystery writer's credo. The mystery writer's credo. If you don't kill someone, is it even a book?
Is it even a book? I don't know. So I've you know, to get the tension going has been a struggle. But it's a book about a friendship between two boys who become very dependent on one another and how that then, what that then does to their lives, basically. So something very different. And I don't think I will do a sequel.
Well, you know, as you said, those characters might come back to haunt you and you might want to go back to Sweden after being in France for a while. Different language, different food. It's been a real delight talking to you, Cecilia. I enjoyed The Historians a great deal. And I want to thank you for writing it. And thank you for talking to us today.
I'm so grateful for being here. Thank you so much for having me.